Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, giant steps in science are unraveling the mysteries of the mind and finding that what we thought was only science fiction may soon be reality. Then, with wildlife traffickers pushing some species to the brink of extinction, we explore if a new international agreement can stop the multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry to rescue our most endangered species. It used to be the stuff of only science fiction, but now science is taking us inside the mysteries of the mind. Can the brain now interface with computers to move matter? Will scientists be able to download our memories and then reload them? Michio Kaku joins us. He is a theoretical physicist at the City College of New York and co-founder of String Field Theory. He's the author of Physics of the Impossible, Physics of the Future, and his newest, The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. Welcome, Michio Kaku. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle.
Glad to be on the show.
Congratulations on the new book, The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. Perhaps we should start with this whole idea of consciousness and what exactly consciousness is. You've said in the book that you think there are levels rather than one single kind of consciousness. How would you explain this phenomenon?
Well, there are over 20,000 or so papers written by philosophers, theologians, ministers, and psychologists about consciousness, and there's no consensus. Never have so many devoted so much to produce so little. However, I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist, and when we approach something like a planet or a star, the first thing we do is create a model. A model of a planet moving in space. Then we calculate the planet moving with respect to other planets. And finally, we run the videotape forward and predict the future motions of the planet. So I divide consciousness into many levels. Even a thermostat, a lowly thermostat, has one unit of consciousness because it measures the temperature. A flower may have, 10 units of consciousness. It measures the temperature, water level, sunlight, direction of gravity. And then we have reptiles. Reptiles are very good at understanding their position in space. I call that level one consciousness. Level two consciousness is that of a monkey. They are social animals, they have emotions, and they have a social hierarchy within the tribe. And then we are at level three, human consciousness, which looks at the future. We daydream. We plan, we scheme, we strategize. Animals don't do that. Animals have no conception of tomorrow to the best of our abilities. When it gets cold, they hibernate. They don't plan. They don't take out their luggage and start to plan to hibernate. No, they just do it by instinct. So I think that means that there are levels of consciousness, and even animals, in fact, even thermostats, have consciousness.
You've said social animals tend to fall into level two. I would assume you mentioned monkeys, but I would assume that would be dogs, that would be elephants, that would be a multitude of animals.
That's right. But their level two consciousness, which is social consciousness, is a little bit different from ours. For example, cats, when they come up to you and they purr, you think, they're so affectionate. But actually, the cat is marking you as part of its boundary by putting hormones on you. The cat is basically saying, this human is mine. He's in my territory. Other cats cannot take my human.
So you've talked about, within this consciousness, one of the big distinguishing elements between humans and other animals that might be on the level two pertains to how we deal with the future and with self-awareness, the planning aspect.
That's right. That's precisely so. Animals, as we understand it, operate by instinct. When the temperature changes, when they see a predator, they immediately respond by instinct. We, on the other hand, plan. This means that IQ may not be the most efficient way to measure intelligence and consciousness. It turns out that people with high IQ as children often wind up as petty criminals, marginal people on the fringes of society. I say that someone who's intelligent plots the future. Think of a safecracker. A safecracker may have low IQ because they flunked out of grade school, but they might see the future of a crime much better than the police, much better than the authorities. They may be able to understand how a bank robbery progresses, what the different options are, and what happens with witnesses and the police. That's why they can outwit the police, because they see the future. And I think that, to me, is a more clear, measurable understanding of intelligence rather than IQ exams.
And self-awareness.
Yes, we put ourselves in this model. We're different. Animals have a conception of where they are in space. Tigers and lions, they can lunge very precisely at their prey. We, however, put ourselves in this model. That is what I call self-awareness. Now, remember, there's no consensus in the scientific community as to what consciousness is. Some people don't even believe it exists. However, I'm a scientist, a physicist, and I give a numerical ranking. You can put numbers on the level of consciousness of machines, animals, and even people, and then you see there's a continuum rather than an abrupt break.
One aspect of this that I thought perhaps might be somewhat different from how you see this was just, like you mentioned, the predator animals do have to plan somewhat for the future. They have to know to crouch down. They have to know where their prey is going to be coming by. So there must be some aspect.
There's a little bit of planning. In animals, we can see that monkeys, for example, when they have see a banana, they'll plan a little bit, but they have no conception of tomorrow, and they don't run simulations of the future.
Right.
For example, to the best of our knowledge, animals have no sense of humor. Animals don't laugh like we laugh. But why do we think something is funny? We think something is funny because we complete the future when we hear a joke, and then we hear that a twist at the end, we laugh. For example, W.C. Fields was once asked the question, what is your opinion about clubs for children? And he said, I'm all in favor of that if kindness fails.
Right.
So, in other words, we expect him to say clubs are good for children, but then he turns it around.
To turn it into the other kind of club.
It's another kind of club, right? And one of Roosevelt's daughter was asked about gossip. And she said, if you have nothing good to say about other people, then come down and sit next to me. So again, we complete the dots. We say, if you have nothing good to say about people, then don't say anything at all. Our parents taught us that, right? So we complete the dots. Animals don't do that. Animals do not anticipate the future, and they certainly don't laugh when they see there's a twist in their understanding and simulation of the future. That's why things are funny.
Let's connect this to what's been going on with the mind and our understanding about the brain. First of all, we've been talking about consciousness, but so much of what we actually do is run in an unconscious state.
Yeah. If you compare the brain to a large corporation, for example, you realize that most of what happens in a large corporation happens independently of the CEO. That's the unconscious mind. The mind is so complex that the CEO only has to make big decisions. The bulk of it is unconscious. So Freud was right. There really is an unconscious mind. And that's the origin of emotions. Why do we have emotions? Because they are rapid-fire reactions to potentially threatening situations. The CEO doesn't have time to evaluate a tiger when you see a tiger. All you have to do is run. So in the same way, emotions are a rapid-fire way of dealing with very complex situations. If your rival, for example, walks into a room that's potentially threatening, you don't have time to figure out all the details about a rival walking into the room. You just get nervous. You get on alert. And so emotions are there to protect us, to protect us against emergencies when there's no time to react to these things.
Whereas there's the thinking rational part.
That's right. That's the prefrontal cortex, and that's right behind your forehead. And so that's the rational part of the brain, and you can actually see the blood flow when you analyze MRI scans of the brain. And you can actually tell about old wives' tale whether they're true or not. For example, there's an old wives' tale that says that when a man looks at a pretty girl, he starts to act stupid. Well, you can actually see that blood drains from the prefrontal cortex when a man sees a pretty girl, and that's why he acts stupid. You can actually see with MRI scans that many of the old wives' tales about thinking are actually true.
How much of what we do and think and this idea of personality is really embedded in the physical component of the brain?
Yes, we now realize that many of the previous theories of personality, like even Freud's theory, We once thought that it was bunk, that you couldn't never prove the existence of the superego, the guilty conscience, the libido, which is desire, and the ego. But actually, we can. You can actually see that when you, for example, see a chocolate cake, you can actually see that the pleasure center of the brain lights up. That's the libido. You want to eat that chocolate cake. But then right behind your eyes is the orbital frontal cortex, your guilty conscience. And your guilty conscience says, bad for you, too much cholesterol, too much sugar. And then right behind your forehead is you. You, the thinking you, sits right behind your forehead, and that's the ego. And it has to decide whether or not it should eat that chocolate cake or not. So consciousness, which was once considered to be too wishy-washy and too squishy to analyze, we can actually assign numbers to these things and quantify thinking.
We can also start to understand more about what we can do scientifically to have a positive impact on people, for example, the brain injured.
That's right. When you see people with strokes, for example, you can actually see what part of the brain, what part of the body is impaired, and then painfully you can construct a map between a certain stroke in a certain part of the brain and a certain part of the body. That's the old way. Now we have scientific instruments, which I'll mention later, like magnetism, where you can actually selectively deaden parts of the brain harmlessly and then watch what happens to the human body. So we don't have to wait for strokes anymore. We can actually use modern technology and use it to deaden parts of the brain and then see what happens to the body. And so we're getting a much better handle now. In fact, in the last 10 years, we've learned more about the brain than in all of human history combined.
That's quite remarkable. You opened your first substantive chapter with a story about a brain injury which caused personality changes. This was a catalyst for some of our understandings.
That's right. You know, historically, no one knew where thinking resided. The Egyptians thought that the brain was a useless instrument, so the Egyptians threw it away when they were embalming the pharaohs. And Aristotle thought that the heart was a seat of thinking and emotions. But then something happened in the 1800s, which changed everything. There was a man named Phineas Gage. He was a railroad worker working with dynamite. The dynamite went off accidentally, and a shaft about 4 feet long went right through his skull, came out the other end, and splattered part of his brain on the floor. Well, you can imagine the chaos that occurred when this happened. Other railroad workers came to his defense. Miraculously, he was alive after that horrendous accident where part of his brain was blown out, and he survived, believe it or not. He was unconscious for a month or so, but he eventually recovered, but his personality changed. All of a sudden, he became much rougher. All of a sudden, people were warned to stay away from him. And that was a sea change in our thinking. We used to think that the brain was not connected to behavior. Now we realize that an injury to a specific part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, changes personality and changes behavior. This was incredible. This was the beginning of modern neurology, when we realized that not only does the brain control thinking and behavior, certain parts of the brain control certain types of behavior.
There have been these studies now that have come out recently that even did the brain scans of serial killers and impulsive killers and finding which parts of the brain were depressed or not functional.
That's right. This raises all sorts of ethical questions about crimes. For example, if you have a serial murderer, some, not all, when under a brain scan, you can see that their pleasure center lights up when they see suffering of other people. So you might say to yourself, oh, my God, these guys are dangerous. They take pleasure in torturing other people. But if they haven't done anything, then, you know, you can't lock up people for thinking about it. But, of course, this is up to the courts to decide how far we want to go. But we're now beginning to see that criminals have a different reaction, pleasure reaction, pain reaction, than the average person. But that doesn't mean that we should lock them up if they haven't committed any crime. Personally, I think that if somebody has done a crime, then he should not use this as an excuse to get out of jail, saying, well, my brain did it. We should lock him up because he is a threat to society.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're speaking with Michio Kaku about the future of the mind. In the common lexicon, we hear quite a bit about left brain, right brain, and your book talks about this, like how the left brain, which is the analytical side, and the right brain is the more holistic side, but we're dominated by the left brain. Some of those experiments that you cited in that book were quite fascinating about how scientists can speak to one side or the other and get a reaction from one side or the other, and sometimes they're quite disconnected.
Yeah, believe it or not, we actually have two brains inside our skull that may have different attitudes and different opinions. Epileptics go into convulsions because the left brain and the right brain feed off each other, creating positive feedback, and it can kill you. So scientists sometimes have to cut the connection between the left and the right hemisphere. And over time, we begin to see two distinct personalities emerge. One personality, for example, could be an atheist. The other one could be a believer. This is amazing. Neurologists have found that two divergent opinions can be formed in the same brain. This means that, in principle, one brain could be a Republican, the other brain could be a Democrat, and can you imagine the chaos that takes place in the voting booth?
Yeah.
Because you only have one arm, and the left arm and the right arm fight, literally fight, for control over the lever when they have to make a decision. So you can talk to the left brain because the left brain controls speech. Talking to the right brain is more difficult. We sometimes talk to the right brain by asking people questions and then looking at what happens when they write the answer with a pen. And then we find two different points of view. You can get one subject and you ask him a question, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the person will say, I want to be an accountant. However, then the other brain with a pen writes down, I want to become a race car driver. So literally, you could have two personalities living in the same brain. This is quite unusual, but it actually happens.
Yeah, this was something that you wrote called split brain, when people actually do have almost like a split brain.
That's right, and this may also be involved with a certain form of mental illness called bipolar disorder. Many of the great actors and actresses of our time had bipolar disorder. Conductors and musicians also, it seems to run in families. And it turns out that one part of the brain is more optimistic, the other part is more pessimistic, and they check each other. So we balance pessimism and optimism. However, in bipolar disorder, apparently this balance gets out of whack. And that's why sometimes they feel manic. They think they're God. They think they can do anything. And then a month later, they want to commit suicide. And we see this quite common in the arts. Many familiar faces, movie stars, have this problem.
Now, generally speaking, you said that the left brain is the dominant side.
That's right. The left side governs speech. It'll actually talk to you, the left side. It governs, rational decisions, while the right side is more artistic and holistic, but does not have access to speech. And we think that an injury to the left side will actually disturb this balance. And we think that, for example, savants who have this enormous mathematical ability, the super geniuses, can arise with an injury to the left part of your brain. One child had a bullet that went through the left side of his brain. Another person hit his head on a swimming pool when he dived into a swimming pool too quickly. And later, they became mathematical geniuses. And we think that people with photographic memory, we think we have a theory of photographic memory. Some of these people, you can say to them, what were you doing 30 years ago on May 2nd at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? And they'll give you the book they were reading, the page number they were reading, and they will recite the line that they were reading. So we now realize that the brain not only records memories, the brain also erases memories, and they're two separate functions. We used to think that forgetting was natural, that we naturally forget. Nope, you have to physically erase the tape. So these people have forgotten how to forget. The forgetting mechanism is broken. It's like a tape recorder gone crazy. It just tape records and never erases.
And so what does that tell us about the other side of people who cannot retain information.
Yes, there's a very sad case of a gentleman decades ago who had an operation, and the surgeon accidentally cut the memory center of his brain, the hippocampus. You could go up to him, shake his hand, he'd be delighted to see you, and then he would forget. He would then again greet people and shake their hands all over again, and he would repeat this on and on and on for decades. He would literally relive the same day because he could not form long-term memories. It's so unusual that movies have been done about this man. 51st Dates with Drew Barrymore is about this man, except now it's a woman who has to have 51st dates. And then the movie Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray relives the same day over and over again. We now realize that there is a memory center, and we can now create a pacemaker that will duplicate some of the function of the hippocampus. This means that we may be able to solve the problem to a degree of Alzheimer's disease. So this is big news, that we can actually record a memory, insert the memory into the hippocampus, and you learn. It was done in a mouse last year. Now it will be done on primates and eventually on Alzheimer's patients. And even beyond that, maybe we'll upload a vacation that you never had, and maybe even the subjects you flunked in college.
We are now able to download memory, essentially, but that also means that you can manipulate memory or cause one to, as you said, have a memory that they didn't have, which could alter one's personality.
That's right. We are, in some sense, our memory. So we cannot alter it now. However, in mice, we can actually upload simple memories now in mice, eventually primates. But that raises the larger question, you know, maybe a decade from now. What happens if you put false memories into a person? That could raise legal questions. On one hand, we may want to insert the memory of a vacation or a calculus course that we flunked into our brain. We may pay to have people do that for us. But it also puts into question our legal system. Our legal system is based on eyewitness accounts. But what happens if you can upload false memories? Then hearsay, everything becomes hearsay at that point. In fact, there's a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger called Total Recall. In the movie, he thinks he's a good guy. Throughout the entire movie, you assume that he's a good guy. Only at the very end of the movie do you realize he's actually the bad guy. But good guy memories were put into his mind. So he is both the hero and the villain of his own movie. A very clever movie. And that could be possible in the future.
That brings up, in addition to legal questions, a lot of ethical questions about what is medically ethical in these cases.
Right. So I think that because these technologies don't yet exist, it's all speculation, but it's coming very fast. And eventually our legal system may have to come to grips with the fact that our memory could be tampered with or even augmented. We may have super memories. We may be able to upload tremendous memories, learn things, learn new skills, for example. Workers who are unemployed could learn new skills and join the employment market again. And students who flunk courses could pass these courses because you can have the memories reinserted. But it also means that if criminals get a hold of this technology, it could create havoc in the legal system because then you can't trust anybody's eyewitness account.
We also have technology that is playing with a telepathic kind of communication as well as a telekinetic kind of activity. How are scientists able to, say, read the thoughts via brain signals?
Okay, well, first of all, the brain is electrical, and it emits a little bit of radio. So this was known for a long, long time. But we didn't have supercomputers that could make sense of the radio and the electrical patterns. Now we do. For example, Stephen Hawking is a colleague of mine. He's a famous physicist. You've seen him on television. Recently, his illness is so bad that he's lost control of his fingertips. He cannot communicate with the outside world anymore. So, since we are physicists, we decided to do something for Stephen. We put a chip in his right glass, which has a radio. It picks up the radio from his brain, deciphers it, and then operates a laptop where he can type. And so he can now actually communicate with the rest of the world by thinking about it. So this means that in the future, when we walk into a room, we may mentally control the lights, the temperature, mentally turn on the TV, mentally, you know, get the car ready, mentally drive the car by thinking. All these things may be done by sheer thought, okay? And in fact, in Japan, you can actually buy a headband with two ears on it. When you talk to somebody that you like, the two ears stand up straight. But then when you're bored with the person you're talking to, the two ears droop. It's the rage of Japan, because it means that you know exactly if you're impressing somebody, and you know exactly if you're boring somebody. So you know ahead of time if you're going to go home that night alone.
Fascinating. Michio Kaku, author of The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Okay, my pleasure.
You've been listening to part one of a two-part discussion with Michio Kaku. Please tune in next week for part two. Next, the politics of wildlife trafficking. Stay tuned.
They dropped me through 12-bit samplers. We are electronic performers. We are electronics.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Despite efforts to preserve endangered animals, trafficking has increased in some parts of the world by an estimated 5,000%, according to conservationists. The poaching is pushing some animals, such as black rhinos and hippos, to the very brink of extinction. In February, 46 countries signed the London Declaration, which works to end wildlife trafficking through law enforcement and cross-country cooperation. U.S. President Barack Obama has an additional national initiative that includes measures such as a ban on trafficked items like elephant tusks. Wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion-dollar-per-year industry that has reportedly been used to fund al-Qaeda-related groups. What is the scope of the problem, and what should be done about it? Three experts join us. David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt also joins us. She is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the scope of the problem. David Wilkie, what would you say we're facing?
Humans have been trafficking wildlife for millennia, and it's remarkable. North Americans actually ate passenger pigeons to extinction. There used to be flocks of 3 billion flying overhead, and we ate every single one of them. Well, the challenge is that we're doing this to more and more species as more and more of humanity gets to a level of wealth where we can all afford to buy things. And so tiger bones, tiger skins, leopard skins, rhino horns, elephant teeth are all trinkets that humans want for prestige or for other reasons. And with 7 billion people on the planet, demand for wildlife products is grossly outstripping the ability for wildlife to supply and meet that demand. So we're in a terrible crisis, and we're going to lose many species unless we do something about it.
As I understand it, the numbers are changing quite drastically and have become much worse, particularly with some of the animals, like you mentioned, tigers, rhinos, and elephants. Do you have a sense of how much worse it is?
Well, there's only about 1,600 female tigers left in the wild. That's a startlingly tiny amount. African elephants, we've gone from 1.5 million savanna elephants to around 300,000. We went from 800,000 elephants in the tropical forests of Africa to 80,000. So we've only got 10% of the elephants in the forests of Central Africa that we used to have. An unbelievable crash in the populations. It's very much the same way that whaling went. We lost almost 95% of our whales, and only when we found fossil fuels in Pennsylvania and started replacing whale oil for lamp oil, did we actually save the whales? So we've got the ability to change the situation. We just need to have a global commitment to do so. And I think we've actually begun to see a sea change in the attitudes of the global community about wildlife trafficking. And Chelsea Clinton and Secretary Clinton have a huge amount to We have got a lot to thank them for actually pushing the global agenda on wildlife trafficking.
Tanya Wyatt, what would you add?
Well, I do think you see geographic differences. You have problems of demand in the United States, in the European Union, also in China and other areas in Asia, such as the Southeast. But then you also see, you know, the developing the global South, we could say, as being the areas that are particularly exploited. Areas obviously in Africa, South America, and again in Asia that are targeted for their wildlife as commodities to be sold into more Western or areas that have growing middle class consumers. So there is a regional and geographic aspect to it that we need to take into consideration when we're developing prevention strategies.
Mark Bickoff.
I agree with everything that's been said. I think we need to have extremely strong enforcement of existing regulations, and maybe the existing regulations aren't really strong enough. I'm always amazed at the sheer numbers of animals who are involved. It's staggering when I read the reports of the millions of members of different sorts of species who are involved in the illegal wildlife trade. So it seems to me that enforcement is really important.
When you say millions of species, the ones we hear most about are the tigers, the rhinos, the elephants, the great apes. David Wilkie, I think you've also written about the great apes. Mark Bickoff, what are the other animals?
When I said millions of species, I was really thinking more the sheer number of individuals in a given species. But the exotic birds, for example, and reptiles who can be stuck in suitcases, for example, and you know, people try to smuggle them in. So that's all I was really referring to.
I see.
This is David. I was just out in Cameroon working with some colleagues of mine to think about how we might set up a conservation agenda for African grey parrots. It never occurred to me that African grey parrots are the most valuable pet on the planet. Because every African grey goes for $1,000 to $10,000 a bird. And we know nothing about them. We don't know about their ecology. We don't know where they feed. We don't know how many there are. They're social birds. They groom one another like primates. And yet we know practically nothing about their ecology. And yet they're the single most valuable pet on the planet. Isn't that startling? And I think this speaks to me about what the trade is about. 89% of Chinese consumers of ivory know that ivory consumption requires the death of an elephant. And 85% of those consumers will say they're going to buy ivory again.
Mm-hmm.
If just 10% of Chinese families who make $16,000 or more a year buy one 2-ounce piece of ivory, that's about the size of a piece of soap that you get in a hotel. That requires 32,600 elephants to die. So the scale of the issue is unbelievable. And yet our ability to, our knowledge of the issue is waning relative to the scale of demand.
Tanya Wyatt, you have been looking at this. You've compared it also to the drug trafficking rings. You say the worst perpetrator is organized crime, but that there are other perpetrators. How would you describe this?
I would say that organized crime might have the largest impact in that they are capable of killing, frankly, more animals than maybe individuals. But you do have all the different levels of people that are actually involved in consumption and involved in demand. So you do have impoverished people that may feel forced to poach or to harvest things illegally. But I'd argue that they're probably having the least amount of impact or killing the least amount of animals. And you do have these larger criminal organizations that may be organized or maybe just structured rather than being our kind of stereotypical mafia kind of organized crime. And those are the kinds of criminals that we need to be worried about because they're the ones that are poaching elephants and rhinos in a very structured and systematic way.
And yet part of it, you mentioned, is also there are all these other actors that are part of the process, states, terrorists, corporations, insurgents. How do you see each of these actors as part of it?
Well, absolutely. It's certainly a long chain of middlemen that it's passing through as well. And states do have a role to play in that. There's arguably corruption is key in facilitating a good deal of wildlife trafficking, which is an area that needs to be studied much more. But corruption of customs, border patrol, police officers, but government officials as well that are facilitating it and profiting from it, that's a big part of it as well. And then there is anecdotal evidence that's becoming more substantiated that terrorists and insurgents are using wildlife, particularly ivory, sometimes timber, as a way to fund their kinds of conflict. And that, too, has a tremendous impact on the survival of these species.
This is David again, I couldn't agree more. I think that the wildlife trade and wildlife trafficking is just one other commodity that's being adopted by organized crime. They traffic arms, they traffic women, they traffic drugs, and now they're just trafficking wildlife. It's just another commodity. But to be honest, I think we've got incredibly powerful tools to tackle that part of the trafficking, the financing of trafficking. U.S. statutes for money laundering are about 20 years old, and it allows for the Treasury Department, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security to actually forfeit assets of people who we believe have gained these assets illicitly. It doesn't require the conviction of someone. It just requires the assumption that the assets have been obtained illicitly. And I think that asset forfeiture has huge potential for the U.S. and the European Union to take a bite out of crime in many ways.
In terms of the law enforcement side of things, do we know how effective these statutes are? When I worked in the legislature here, one of my first observations was we have good laws in the books, but we don't have them enforced. Is that the same situation here?
That's what I was saying. This is Mark about enforcement. I agree that holding assets would be a very powerful tool, but it just, I don't know, maybe I'm a skeptic on it. It just seems the corruption is so widespread that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to enforce already existing regulations or laws.
This is again David. I would agree with that too. But two colleagues of mine, Sam Strindberg and Fiona Meisel, looked at 10 years of data on the changes in elephant numbers in Central Africa. The results were devastating. It was a huge collapse of elephant populations in Central Africa. And they used really credible data to show that. But the upside of that was they showed that anywhere in Central Africa where rangers were actively patrolling, elephants survived. We know that good and effective ranger patrolling is a hugely successful activity to prevent poachers coming in and whacking elephants for their ivory. Regardless of corruption, it actually works. So we know that ranger patrolling works, and the conservation community has come together and developed this new consortium called SMART, which is to try and roll out the next generation of really clever tools to help eco-guards, rangers, park service people to do patrolling the most effectively as possible. And we've got credible evidence to show that that matters, that it makes a difference. Where rangers are patrolling, elephants survive. Where rangers aren't patrolling, elephants disappear. So, yes, corruption is a huge problem, but we've got some tools that can actually make a difference.
I had read that a lot of technology was being developed in a way that could also aid in the enforcement of these laws, technology that is actually controversial in other ways, such as drones. Is this actually being developed for conservation purposes, or is it just far off into the future? Tanya White?
Andrew Lemieux, another colleague of mine, and I believe that they have been actually testing drones in Uganda, is my sense of it. So I do think it's maybe a bit further along than we would have guessed.
This is David again. Yes, UAVs are actually really useful. And to be honest, they're useful for two reasons. UAVs or drones let eco-guards, who are typically far less sophisticated and armed than the poachers who they're against, it lets a ranger patrol figure out whether people that they're hearing at a salt lick, are they hunter-gatherers who've got legitimate reasons to be there, or are they illegal hunters who have got AK-47s and RPGs and could... So drones help rangers save themselves from getting into a firefight and actually getting killed. So I think drones have huge potential to increase the safety of ranger patrolling. And drones also have a huge potential of reaching out, allowing a ranger patrol to patrol a far larger area than they would on foot. And this is particularly important in the forest. So yes, we are actively using drones to extend the reach of eco-guards and to protect eco-guards from bumping into much more seriously armed individuals and much more ruthless individuals who are poaching ivory.
To me, then, we're more on the ground, because at the beginning we were talking, you know, just about corruption and enforcement of regulations and holding assets, which I think is really a great idea as well, but I think it's really very difficult to enforce. But I love what you're talking about in terms of local types of control. When I was in Kenya, I mean, I talked to some people, and one of the points they made was, you know, in some ways the people doing this are just trying to survive, and you can pay them to kill animals or you can pay them to protect animals. And it's not that they're nasty people, it's just they're very poor and they need an income. So I'm liking the idea of, you know, acting locally and thinking globally, if you will.
Well, that brings up a case study that Tanya Wyatt did. Tanya, you did this case study about Cambodia and some of the efforts they've made there that seem to have had an element of success.
Well, I think it's similar to what Dr. Wilkie was talking about of NGOs that have been quite progressive and have years ago realized that rangers do make the difference in protecting species. And so I was an intern and have written about Wildlife Alliance, you know, fundraising and paying the salary of rangers to go in and actually do these patrols and protect these areas. And I do think that they've had some success. It's very promising of not only preventing poaching, but then also rescuing animals that have been poached and rehabilitating them and hopefully returning them to their habitats.
It sounded also that there was an education program there in Cambodia that was really teaching people about the ecology and about the need for biodiversity. Was that also part of it?
Yeah, that's a great program that the Wildlife Alliance has developed there, that they have a van that they drive around to the more remote villages throughout southwest Cambodia and really focus on young people and go into the grade schools and to children that are around the age of 6 and 7 and teach them the value of conservation and biodiversity and how we need to protect our environment, which is really the age we need to be targeting to kind of change the entitlement that some people feel to consume wildlife. And so I think it's a great program, and I do think that they're showing some success after years of doing it.
I love the idea of working with youngsters. I think it's really the key, one of the big keys to the future.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about wildlife trafficking, the problem and the potential solutions. David Wilkie?
One of the interesting things is that wildlife trafficking is a destabilizing thing. It's usually outsiders coming in and taking the resources of local people. Local people don't like that. They don't like it because it's their resources. They don't like it because it increases violence and instability and insecurity, and that's not good for development. So one of the neat things that's happening as mobile phone and cell phone coverage extends, is we actually have the capacity to have anonymous whistleblowing that allows for local people to say, hey, you know, I've noticed some weird stuff happening in my neighborhood. And to me, this sort of crowdsourced intelligence networks, again, have huge potential to extend the reach of law enforcement. And law enforcement always sounds bad. I think of it as crime prevention. To me, if I say crime prevention, everyone likes it. If you say law enforcement, it sounds more like a fascist state. But crime prevention through crowdsourcing, to me, has huge potential of changing the game. Because local people don't want armed militias coming into their neighborhood and shooting the critters that they could potentially make a profit on through tourism or something else.
One other thing that I saw in one of your papers pertained to really the buyers of certain products. Now, this was specifically, I think, about bushmeat. But you had found that as the prices went up really high, the consumption went down quite a bit. Is there an answer on that side as well?
Well, bushmeat's a necessity for many people. It's a source of dietary protein. So that's different from a luxury good like ivory or rhino horn. So the economics of the trade is fundamentally different. When you drive the price up of a necessity, people will look for a substitute. There is no substitute for rhino horn or elephant ivory, and that's the trick. And that's why ban on sales and burning caches of illicitly harvested ivory is so important. I'm really looking forward to Tanzania burning their 122 tons of ivory. That means that ivory will not leak back into the market. Public crushing or burning of ivory sends a huge message. And I think that the Obama administration, by banning ivory sales effectively in the United States, is going to encourage China and Vietnam, the two largest consumer nations, to think really hard. Do they want to be international citizens? Do they want to be a part of the international community? And it's going to put enormous pressure on those governments to do something about the ivory trade.
Let's take a look at both President Obama's task force and also the London Declaration. Mark Bekoff, have you had some time to digest what has gone on in February?
Sort of. I did. I think that what has gone on is a really good move in the right direction. And I work in China a bunch with one of the Moon Bear Rescue projects, and I love the people there, but I'm not so optimistic about change there, not because the people are necessarily heartless, but just because the sheer numbers and the sheer money involved. That's what I've heard from people there working in other areas of animal protection, is that it's just so hard to get your foot in the door just because of the numbers and the money.
Tanya Wyatt?
We have followed, I read the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking coming out of the U.S., and then I was at the International Wildlife Trafficking Symposium that happened before the conference in London, and I'm encouraged that it's on the political agenda and it's finally getting attention that probably the three of us on the panel have been talking about for years. So it is encouraging. I probably would share some colleagues' reservations, though, that I worry that it could go the path of being too militarized and paramilitarized, and we have the same kind of battle that we had with the war on drugs, to where we just throw lots of money and lots of law enforcement at it, and we don't actually make the changes on the ground to provide people with alternative livelihoods and things that need to be done to really stamp out the problem. But hopefully all of that will come into play as well as efforts increase.
So you see part of the missing components as really an economic component for people to have an alternative to this process.
I do, yes. That's how we help local communities to not poach and not harvest things illegally. You've got to tackle demand. Yes, there's crime prevention, but there's also changing the paradigm of how we view wildlife can be consumed. And that's the most challenging task ahead for us.
David Wilkie, how would you assess the international community's efforts, and how would you assess the Obama administration's efforts?
If you'd asked me that question 9 months ago, I would have said we're not doing anything. And what I'm absolutely startled is the marvelous mobilization of international interest and support for the ivory trafficking issue. I agree with everyone on the panel that we need to tackle wildlife trafficking. It's a trade good. So we need to tackle it along the commodity chain. from the source points where poaching is happening to national transit to international transit to the consumers. We need to tackle all the way along the supply chain. Absolutely. What we've learned with China is really interesting. We thought that we could use campaigns that have been very successful in the United States and in Europe, using movie stars or sports stars as spokespeople for the trade. When we actually interviewed Chinese ivory consumers, we said, you know, if Yao Ming, this wonderful, really tall basketball player, said, don't buy ivory, would that change your impressions? Would that change your opinions? 3% of ivory consumers said that would change their ivory purchasing behavior.
37%. That's interesting. Yao Ming is a very strong supporter of the Moon Bear Rescue Program I work with.
And he's fantastic. He's a marvelous advocate.
Yeah.
But 37% of Chinese ivory consumers said if the government banned it, they would stop consuming ivory. 25% said if Politburo members said that it was inappropriate to buy ivory, they would stop buying ivory. I think one of the things we really need to do is understand the consumer. And we're getting a better handle on that. And we're getting to understand how we can use social media, how we can use pressure on the governments to change behavior. And that's a significant difference to 9 months ago.
One other aspect of this that I had been thinking about, and Mark Beckhoff, one of your edited volumes on conservation, asked a question in an important way. It said, who lives, who dies, and why? How would you answer that today?
It was in my book, Ignoring Nature No More, The Case for Compassionate Conservation. And there's essays in there that talk about the wildlife trade. I think individuals are making that decision. What they just said, I didn't know those data. And I think about American advertisement, you know, where LeBron James says something and the stock in a company goes either up or down significantly. I didn't know that about China. But I think the people who are making that, answering the question, who dies, who lives, who dies, and why, are really the locals. And that's why, like I said before, I'm not saying much new right now, is getting to them in whatever way. So if they can be influenced by government policy or what Politburo people say, that would be the way I go. But I also don't think that people realize that they are basically making that decision. And that's why, you know, the who dies, who lives, who dies, and why has sort of become my little bumper sticker. And when I talk to people about it in terms of other issues with non-human animals, it actually gives them pause because that's basically at issue. We are making these decisions about the lives of individual animals.
Tanya Wyatt, one of your studies also looked at how birds are being smuggled in Oceania, going from Australia to New Zealand and then getting trafficked out. Given New Zealand's reputation for actually protecting the environment and other species, does that become part of it? Are countries like Australia and New Zealand then going to have to crack down on this?
They're definitely hugely involved in the international discussion around wildlife trafficking. The John Scanlon, the current Secretary General of CITES, is Australian, and those people have been actively involved in it. And New Zealand's an interesting case because they were the first, really, to come up with a wildlife enforcement network. So they were good in predicting that this was going to be an issue. It does obviously come down to funding. They've had trouble maintaining the resources that are going to those units. But I think Australia is actually a good example because they have much stricter CITES regulations than other countries. And I think that's why, in part, why they've managed to keep their amounts of illegal trade so low. And as I've written in that article, it might be wise for New Zealand possibly to consider having stricter CITES regulations as well, and the UK as well, because it does tend to be a hub here in London for illegal trade.
David Wilkie.
The charismatic species always get the headlines. The pangolins, the seahorses, the sharks, critters that people either think are slimy or unpleasant or dangerous don't get into the headlines. And I would just like listeners to understand that the wildlife trade is rhinos and elephants and tigers, but it's a whole host of other species that are being overexploited because 7 billion people is a lot of demand. And we can no longer feed off the planet. We can no longer eat off the planet. We can no longer just take what we need. 89% of the terrestrial landscape is dominated by humans. That's a lot. Humanity has to decide if we want to save things or not. And for my children and my children's children, I want elephants to be there. I want rhinos to be there. I want sharks to be there. I want seahorses to be there. I want a future where my great-great-grandchildren get to see what I see. And thus, we need to fix the wildlife trade.
Mark Beckoff.
I agree. I'm so influenced by Ed Wilson. You know, Wilson, he had a great quote about how really ants and the insects are the animals with whom we should be concerned. And since I've studied social carnivores, I mean, I love them and they are charismatic, but he basically really has convinced me that somehow we have to have people become aware of the incredible importance of the non-charismatic animals. And, you know, there's a size thing there, too, because a lot of times they're the ones who can be put into a suitcase. You know, you can't put an elephant into a suitcase, but you can put a lot of little animals into a suitcase or into a backpack and smuggle them. So in my own work, I try to stress that, you know, especially with kids, take them on hikes and take them on walks and have them focus on the little animals who they think are slimy and ugly and, you know, the ones to whom they go, ooh, I wouldn't want that animal around me.
Tanya Wyatt.
No, I would agree with both of them, with Dr. Beckoff and Dr. Wilkie, enthusiastically, that we need to have that shift that wildlife is not just instrumentally valuable to humans, that it's intrinsically valuable and beautiful and has its own right to life.
Absolutely, Tanya. I couldn't agree more with you.
Thank you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Great. Well, thank you
very much for inviting me to join this conversation.
David Wilkie is a wildlife ecologist, a professor at Boston College, and the director of conservation support at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Tanya Wyatt is a lecturer of wildlife criminology at the University of Northumbria and the author of Green Criminology in Wildlife Trafficking, The Illegal Fur and Falcon Trades in Russia Far East, and Wildlife Trafficking, A Deconstruction of the Crime, the Victims, and the Offenders. Mark Beckoff is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. His books include The Emotional Lives of Animals, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, The Fascinating Science of Animal Intelligence, Emotions, Friendship, and Conservation, and Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening, and if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.